Doctor. You may proceed.
Good morning, may I please report, I am Lee Smallwood, and I represent Mr. Dew. Now request that I have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Mr. Dew pled guilty and was duly convicted of aggravated malicious wounding, and carnal knowledge, and was sentenced to a life sentence with also 20 years in prison and 10 years in prison, and the active sentence result was 50 years in prison. Additionally, the trial court imposed a condition of lifetime probation after his incarceration on the condition of his suspended sentence, and also a condition that he have no contact with any of his family. I believe that was the 28th of October 2014 when Mr. Dew stood for sentencing. On the 29th of October, I filed a motion on his behalf challenging lifetime probation and also the no contact provision. And the judge responded denying that motion on the 31st of October.
So the defendant will be actively incarcerated for how many years total?
My understanding was 50 years. It was 30 years for aggravated malicious wounding.
So probation will kick in, arguably, upon his release, not before. You don't have probation during incarceration in the Department of Corrections.
That would be my understanding, yes.
So we're debating a condition that the trial court placed on a probationary period that's going to arise a half century from now.
Exactly. I think that's exactly correct in terms of the probationary condition. The condition of no contact, it's my understanding at least, is a condition that will encumber Mr. Dew not only once he's released, but also during the 50 years that he's incarcerated or whatever portion thereof that is actually his incarceration.
Well, if it's a condition of probation, probation doesn't exist during active incarceration. The DOC will determine the contact, if any.
Was it also a condition of the suspension of the sentence?
That is my understanding. That was a condition of the suspension of the sentence.
And, well, can you point specifically to where that is made clear?
Oh, yes, certainly. I know that the sentencing order would be that, and I apologize.
Obviously, Justice Kelsey is right about the probation aspects of this. But if he were to have contact with his family, who, of course, were the victims of this absolutely horrific series of events, he could face a revocation of that suspended sentence if he tries to make the contact while he's in prison. But if it's not actually included as a condition of the suspension, it raises a question about that.
Oh,
that's
yes,
why I'm asking.
I would agree, and I think that it's Joint Appendix 193, additional provisions. The order indicates defendant shall have no contact of any kind with his father, or stepmother, or half-sister, directly or indirectly, by way of telephone, social media, internet, chat, text, correspondence, or via messages. And that is indicated under a heading on the prior page, Joint Appendix 192, of suspended sentence conditions. So it's my understanding that that's a condition of the suspended sentence and not a condition of the probation.
All right.
So that's why we would conceive of that as something that is a part of what he has to do even while he's incarcerated. And in fact, the judge in the trial court indicated, this is Joint Appendix 170 into 171, that even if his stepmother, who affirmatively wanted to have contact with him, and that was so represented by the attorney for the Commonwealth, that if she wrote him, that was fine, but if he responded in any way, that the judge would impose the balance of the sentence. He went on later in the letter of the 31st of October to indicate that he just meant that essentially Mr. Dew was in jeopardy of having the balance of that sentence imposed, and not that he was pre-deciding that. To address some of the contentions of the Commonwealth in this issue, in this case, we would contend the issue of no contact extends to the whole family, and that it isn't precluded by Rule 5, Column 25, that there is proper preservation. And candidly, it's not because I said anything in my motion about anyone other than the stepmother, because I didn't. It's because on the judge's own initiative, he actually expanded his reasoning out to the entire family in his letter of the 31st.
Is the stepmother the only one who objected on that side of things? In other words, I know your client objected across the board, but did
yes, that is correct.
Was she the only one who had a problem with this on the family side?
She is the only one that we know anything about the position on contact from. I think the father, given his care in the nursing home, it may have been difficult to ascertain a position, and the minor child, I think it's also kind of natural that we don't have a position. We don't have them affirmatively asking for no contact, however.
Now that we know what he cannot do, what is the legal basis for your challenge?
The legal basis for the challenge, we would contend, is that the General Assembly prohibits this type of prohibition on contact. The 19.2-303 addresses prohibiting contact with family members only in the context of gang members, and it's clear that Mr. Dew is not a gang member. Also, in terms of the analysis, that this is abuse of discretion, that this is not a term that is reasonably related, that we would contend it's like the state Supreme Court decision in the Loving case that we cite, where the Lovings had been ordered by the trial court up in, I think that's...
The trial court here believed that there was a realistic risk of manipulation by the defendant based upon not only the incident, but the acts leading up to it immediately before the trial. Why doesn't the trial judge have that discretion? Putting aside your argument that somehow 303 displaces all trial court discretion in such matters.
I'm just trying to make sure I answer
the trial court your could question. Have put Mr. Dew in prison for life.
Oh, yes.
And you're complaining about a no-contact aspect of a condition, either to probation or suspension sentence or to both. How can that not be a lesser-included discretionary power of the court if there is any arguable basis for it?
Well, we would contend, and again, certainly this is a statute that is not strictly construed, but the General Assembly has expressed its position on the matter, and it's because family is a special situation, that certainly the court in cases of non-family victims can impose no contact.
So let me make sure I'm understanding. If your argument is in non-gang cases, trial courts have no authority whatsoever in any circumstances to issue no contact orders as a condition of suspension or probation.
This type of no contact order, yes, we would take that position.
Where so if he were threatening his stepmother, if he were issuing statements that would cause fear in her, and she's begging the trial judge to give her some protection, the court would have no authority to do that.
No, I think the court would have authority to do that, but I think the court would have authority to do that in prescribing contact in ways that have not been done in this case. For instance, indicating that there could be contact, but only if she first takes the affirmative step to try to visit him in the prison, or indicating that there can be contact, but in no way that contact can be threatening, in much the same way as we have protective orders that require peaceful contact, not no contact. In terms of someone who hasn't reached majority, a no contact order that covers the period of time until they reach majority, or the sets a period of time that is less than for the rest of the natural lives of these various people. One that indicates that the contact has to be first initiated by the victim, But once it's initiated and that victim has said, I want to speak with you, the appellant defendant, Mr. Dew, can then say, I'm going to respond to your letter in much the same way that the court allowed Mrs. Ogg to say, even if it's briefly, please, I can't have contact with you. Talk with your attorney. He can talk with me.
I'm just trying to figure out the legal basis for this. I mean, as a matter of fairness, maybe or discretion, maybe I would have done something different. I don't know. But is it substantive due process? Is it? I mean, you alluded to the statute, but beyond that, is there anything we can?
Well, I think that yes, there is certainly a due process argument to be made here, and that is where we would find a constitutional type of.
And I'm just not aware of anything along those lines. I mean, you have those cases that talk about a right of parents to bring up their children, and that limits, in some circumstances, the ability of the state to interfere with that relationship. That's not this. And this is a stepmother, so, you know, the cases tend to focus on biological parents. So I'm just at a loss to figure out what hook we have to do what you ask us to do.
Well, I mean, I think that the statute permits you to do that, and I think the review for abuse of discretion and determining that this is not reasonably related does as well, and I think the there is constitutional, mostly due process underpinnings by which the court can say, yes, we can do that. And that,
Counsel, well, how is it not reasonably related?
Well, we'd suggest it's not reasonably related because we have a 21-day rule here in Virginia. We have, because the trial court indicates essentially Ms. Doom might try to influence the outcome of him being in prison for 50 years is his reasonable basis. We have Rule 1:1. We have very limited, only executive clemency. He can't ask for a writ of actual innocence because he entered a guilty plea.
What we have is he rapes a 13-year-old half-sister. He badly beats his father and his stepmother. He is given a life imprisonment expanded term, a 50-year active incarceration term, and somehow the U.S. Constitution is offended by a no-contact order.
Yes, because we hold, and I think this is all under due process, the nuclear family relationship is at stake here is one of the most
I think he destroyed his nuclear family relationship by the facts of this crime, would you not?
I think that an argument can be made for that, and I think that if the family in no way contacted him ever again, that would hold up, but we allow families, even families that have been injured, to decide for themselves. And that's what the judge here has offended and violated, the rights of the aggrieved family members to seek some peace with us, along with my client.
And you don't come forward as the advocate for the aggrieved family members, though. You come forward as the advocate for the person who caused the grief.
I agree with that, and yet.
So if they believe that their constitutional rights have been violated, they have recourse as well, do they not?
Well, the problem is that it is difficult to imagine a way the family members can actually have recourse because they can write Mr. Dew and do everything that they desire, but he is the one that's under the order, and he's the one who can't respond at risk of the rest of his life that hasn't been taken for prison. If he does respond to them, no matter how their pleas may be, we suggest that there is something terrible and cruel about that, perhaps not to the degree of an Eighth Amendment violation, but to one that would be a due process type of violation.
You had wanted to save some time, and you're down to 54 seconds.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. The trial court in this case imposed valid sentences for three crimes. The court was not required to suspend any time for any of those sentences. As a matter of grace, the court did suspend portions of the malicious wounding and the aggravated malicious wounding sentence. The conditions of the suspension were reasonable for both rehabilitation and also for the protection of society, particularly the family members who were the victims of the crimes. And because the trial court did not abuse its discretion in fashioning the terms of the sentence and the conditions of the suspension, and the Court of Appeals did not err in refusing to disturb that judgment, this court should affirm the judgment below. I'd like to address specific arguments that counsel has made today. First of all, it sounded to me that he was arguing that the statute of 192-303 did not permit this in a non-gang case, did not permit no contact in non-gang cases. And I think that, as we argued on brief, under rules of statutory construction, this court should never read a statute so that it leads to absurd results. And certainly to say that a trial court could never, in a non-gang case, impose a no-contact condition of suspension would lead to that kind of a result.
Well, there wouldn't be absurd in the manner in which we have used that doctrine. Absurd means that it will not be capable of being carried out. It's capable. You may not like it, but it's not absurd under our doctrine of absurdity. Go ahead.
Your Honor, I would also point out that even the appellant on brief argued, and this is page 10 of his brief, that it was understandable the trial court could impose a period of no contact with the half-sister, but not a lifetime of no contact.
Well, you have plenty of arguments. Just the absurdity with regard to statutory construction is not one of them.
Your Honor, I will focus on another argument then and say that under the statute itself, 192-303, does not provide that a trial court could prohibit someone from driving. We know from the Simmers case that happened. A court found as a reasonable condition of suspension in that case, even though there was only a 10-year sentence, that the defendant was prohibited from driving for 20 years. That was not specifically provided for in the statute, but it was a reasonable condition.
But obviously the statute is not even purporting to be an exhaustive list of the powers of a court in sentencing.
Certainly that is true, and the statute changes from time to time. For instance, there's now a GPS provision in that statute. Obviously, a few years ago, that wasn't there. And so the mention of some things really does not preclude the court, as long as those conditions are reasonable. That is the only requirement that the statute has. Obviously, under 192.303.1, the time that one can receive, the total sentence, the maximum period, is not a limitation on a condition of suspension. And so in this case, we have the two factors that are very important for the trial court imposing the conditions that it did. The court referred to the crimes as horrific. In fact, the court referred to the crimes as beyond understanding. So this is a crime that occurred involving each member of this family, the father, the stepmother, and the half-sister. And so the court, after the guilty plea, and the only condition on the plea agreement was that one of the aggravated malicious woundings was reduced to malicious wounding, the court then, during sentencing, heard the devastation to this family and commented that the guidelines were ridiculously low and recognized his duty to protect the citizens from due. And those citizens, of course, include the victims of this crime. Upon the motion for reconsideration of these conditions, the court issued an opinion letter, which is found at 225 to 226 of the appendix. And the court found that it understood that its conditions must be reasonable. And it again referred to the horribly violent and unprovoked crime. But in dealing with the no contact, the court expressly stated its concern for what happened after this defendant was arrested and prior to his guilty plea hearing. And that was, he contacted his family in an effort to entice them to not cooperate with the police, to not show up for the trial, and if they did show up for the trial, to not testify, even
you know,
encouraging
counsel,
them.
Am I correct that the family was able to resist those overtures? They did show up, they did testify?
Well, actually, Your Honor, since it was a guilty plea, there wasn't a requirement that they come and testify. But yes, the pastor and the stepmother provided victim impact statements. He was not successful in encouraging them to not cooperate. Yes, you are correct.
And the stepmother specifically requested that she be allowed contact with him. I don't know if she went so far as to say, and he be allowed to contact me back. But she specifically made a request for contact.
Your Honor, that was the representation of the prosecutor, that the stepmother had said she did not want the no contact provision to apply to her. And when that was mentioned to the court, I believe this is 170 to 171 of the appendix, the court indicated that the stepmother could make contact. However, the court reiterated that the no contact went from the defendant to the family members. Yes, those are the correct pages. That it was the requirement that he not have contact with those family members. And in the opinion letter, the court was explaining why. It was during contact from the defendant to his family members that he attempted to have.
Which was the basis for my first question.
Yes,
they
ma'am.
Had been able to resist his urges to not show up, to not testify. And I will tell you I'm having some trouble getting to. I understand the high burden, but commits a clear error of judgment. Here is a stepmother saying, I don't want this imposed on me. I want to be able to contact my child. I understand your argument will be she can contact him, he just can't respond. But I'm not sure if she was limiting it to, I want to send him a letter and never hear back from him. And so that plea from that mother, shouldn't that be taken into consideration? Where is the rehabilitation aspect of that? Or is it just your argument that it's just protection?
Well, I think that it goes to both of those. And we cited a case on brief that was from Federal Court, Holloway was the name of it, where it was a prison tax fraud kind of scheme. And one of the conditions of the sentence there was that this defendant could not have contact with prisoners.
Because he had been contacting the prisoners to effectuate the tax.
Exactly. And so, but in addressing not only the protection of society, the court in that case said that it was going to take away the instrumentality. In other words, this is how the crime got started. And so without the ability of this defendant to contact the family, that went to the court's concern that he would attempt to undermine this conviction because he had tried so diligently to keep them from assisting with the conviction in the first place. And I think that it's very important to look at all of the circumstances. This court noted in Murray, in reversing that conviction, that the reason that the condition in that case was not reasonable was because it did not assist with rehabilitation or public safety. It did not.
What do you mean by undermine the conviction? What does that mean?
Well, Your Honor, counsel made a good point that since in Virginia, since this defendant pled guilty, there would not be an opportunity for a writ of actual innocence, but there would be obviously some. There could be attempts to somehow overturn this conviction.
Well, there's only one way to do it that I can see, and that's executive action.
Your Honor, I think that, well, certainly but there are a number of extraordinary writs that could be filed and whether they would participate and assist with that. And I realize that actual innocence is not a basis for a writ of habeas corpus, but obviously convicted defendants file pleadings and proceedings in courts routinely seeking.
Oh, we're very well aware of that.
Yes, sir, I'm sure you are.
But I don't understand the undermine the conviction language. I just don't see it. Again, you have plenty of great arguments. I just don't think that one even.
Maybe procure some kind of affidavit from family that says, well, we told the lawyer this, and the lawyer didn't follow up, and the lawyer was ineffective. I mean, is that what you had in mind? Or?
Certainly affidavits from family members are routinely provided when extraordinary writs are filed in this manner.
But isn't the big problem with that whole thing is that this is all on videotape. I mean, it's not like, oh, it was somebody else who hit me with the bat. No, we've got a picture of him doing it. So I don't see how that could even be a concern.
Yeah, I think there's a lot playing into this. and why we grant so much discretion to the trial court. You'll notice in the opinion letter from the trial court also mentions the defendant's demeanor at sentencing. Well, obviously, a cold record like this, we don't know what the defendant's demeanor was at sentencing. But we're looking at all of the factors that are surrounding. We do know what he said at allocution, that he hoped he learned from this and could write a book and make a movie.
Well, let me ask you this. And, I mean, what if his demeanor was the worst you could possibly imagine at sentencing? And the judge enters this order, and his stepmother says, I would like to see my son. I would like to write my son. And the judge says, no, you cannot, because he might entice you to change your mind about what you said or what is on the videotape. Would that be rational?
I think it is reasonable in this case. I'm sorry, you asked me rational, and I was...
Yeah, I said reasonable.
I think it is reasonable in this case, given all of the factors. This is a small community. This is a family. The three members of the family, and frankly, another consideration, and I hope this is perhaps a stronger argument, one of the considerations in fashioning the sentence and even the conditions of suspension are all of the factors surrounding it, and this is such a horrible crime, and I think that, as Justice Kelsey was mentioning earlier, this is a defendant who has destroyed his family. His father is in a nursing home, and he couldn't even provide a victim impact
statement. It's horrible. I mean, it's no doubt about it. It's horrible. But it seems like to me the question is, on my understanding of the order, is that his stepmother cannot come to visit him in prison if she wants to.
His stepmother can obviously provide contact through the written word.
Right, but she cannot come to see him in prison.
That would involve contact. I would say you are correct, given the way this is written.
So it's really taken away her right to visit her son.
But the court's responsibility in this case is to fashion an appropriate sentence to both deal with rehabilitation, but also to protect society and protect
his family.
Does
your argument on rehabilitation cut both ways when you talk about the nuclear family having been destroyed? As I understand the facts, there were only three other people in the United States that this gentleman knows. And so if rehabilitation is going to be with contact with the outside world, he doesn't know anybody else in the United States. I guess he could get mail from overseas, but it seems to me that argument cuts both ways.
And of course, Your Honor, he can receive mail from his family. He cannot respond to them because that was more the court's concern, was his contact with them.
Okay, the mail, I'll grant you that. But
right.
the rehabilitation, contact with the outside world, people who will visit the person in prison. There was no one else to visit him other than the stepmother.
I think based on the record, he at least was, those are the people that he knew well. They spoke the same language. They were part of the same community. And I would say that probably in balancing this trial court, in balancing the rehabilitative concerns and the punishment concerns, that there was a heavy weight on the punishment.
Did the stepmother make an appearance in the trial court at any point to address the trial judge?
Not to my knowledge. She must have been present at the sentencing because the prosecutor made that proffer. And the way I read the transcript, it was happening right then. She was passing on.
So other than the prosecutor's remark about what something she said,
correct,
which is obviously hearsay, we have no idea why she said it, if she said it, in what context she said it, under what time frame she said it, whether she was under duress when she did say it. She's not here.
No, Your Honor, we have the prosecutor's proffer. And
so if we're vindicating the rights of someone who's not here, we don't know what they would say if they were here.
That's correct. That's correct.
Well, the dilemma, it seems to me, is that this is... It appears to be very carefully tailored. You may write him, he can't write you.
Correct.
And if you want to put this in its proper perspective, the trial court has denied the possibility of a relationship. I mean, contact, writing, this and that, boil it all down, the trial court has basically prohibited a relationship. And if you look at it in that context, it seems to me that's really what we're looking at as the best argument for the convicted man.
I see my time is up. I'm going to respond to that. I believe under the facts and circumstances of this particular case and all that went on with the crime and leaving the parents for dead and the activities prior to the guilty plea, that the court was not unreasonable, did not have an unreasonable...
Well, you may be right. I'm just trying to fashion the question in a way that's not as sterile as you can write, but he can't respond. We're talking about a relationship being terminated. That's what it is, and I just want to call it what it is.
Your Honor, it's our position that that...
Well, you may be right. You may be reasonable under the horrific terms of this case.
Yes, sir. And we would urge the court to affirm.
You have 58 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you. I think I would start exactly where the court left off. This is a situation where the court has precluded relationships between these persons. These are nuclear family relationships. That's the reason that 19.2-303 only indicates such relationships can be prohibited when there's gang activity, because the General Assembly has made that balance.
I don't think that's what the statute says. I mean, for whatever it's worth, you can use your last seconds the way you want, but it says unless expressly ordered, and that just covers everything else.
Well, and certainly, but I think that it at least goes to the sensibilities that we have about the nuclear family and how there has to be a really good reason, a reason even stronger than what we have in this case, to preclude those relationships.
I can't imagine a case that would have reason stronger than this case.
It's difficult to do so.
And I mean, if it doesn't operate in this case, it can't operate in any case. A rape of a stepsister, the brutal beating of the father with a bat to the point where he can't even function, the beating of the mother, they're all left for dead. I mean, can you imagine anything worse than that?
Well, yes. We have essentially here just a carnal knowledge situation, not a forcible rape of the child. So there's that. There's no actual killing. There's no amputation of limbs. There are horrors, unfortunately, that are greater horrors than this case. But I would agree that this is certainly in the top tenth of a percent of the horrors that could be imagined.
All right, your time has expired. Call the next case.